All right, folks, welcome to According to Sam. This is episode 205, and thank you for tuning in. Thank you for watching, listening. Happy Passover to everyone. Hope you had a great weekend. I don't know how you could have with the way that we were sold out this weekend by our Congress, but despite that, I hope you had a good weekend. I don't want to waste any time. I have a lot to share with you guys, and I want to get right into today's podcast. We're going to pick up where we left off in the last podcast, and I want to pick up on this interview that Speaker Johnson did last week before the vote on Saturday. I think this was Thursday night. He did this interview. We played a little bit, or this was a press conference. Sorry, not an interview, press conference. And we played a little bit of this in the last podcast. I'm not going to play much of it today, but I want to focus on one question that he was asked in this press conference. Let's take a listen.
Will a majority of Republicans support the aid package for Ukraine?
Oh, I believe they will. I believe they will. I mean, we've not.
I believe they will. I believe they will. So the question was, will a majority of Republicans support the aid package to Ukraine? He says, I believe they will.
Will a majority of Republicans support the aid package for Ukraine?
Oh, I believe they will. I believe they will. I mean, we've not whipped that yet, in a formal whip count. But anecdotally, I can tell you that most of my colleagues, I think, understand the necessity of that now.
Well, that's not true. That's not true, because we have the whip count now. We have the whip count now. Now, why is this important, this question important? Why is it important to know the Republican Speaker of the House if the majority of Republicans will be voting for aid to Ukraine? Why is that an important question? Because in the Senate, the Senate voted on this supplemental aid package back in February. Now, Republicans don't control the Senate, but they do control the House of Representatives. And if you see right here, the votes in the Senate to pass this $95 billion in supplemental foreign aid when we're $35 trillion in debt. If you look at the vote here, you'll see that that passed the Senate 70 to 29. One vote not voting, but 70 to 29 is what it passed in the Senate. And you remember after they passed it in the Senate, Joe Biden and everybody went around and saying, you know, this is bipartisan. You know, we have bipartisan legislation. Well, look at the nays right here. These are the nays. And there were 29 nays. Of the 29 nays, the two senators from Vermont, Bernie Sanders and Peter Welch, two senators from Vermont, they both voted against this foreign aid. And then you had Jeff Merkley from Oregon, who also voted no. So you had three Democrats vote no. The rest of these are all Republicans. So that's 23 Republicans voted against this foreign aid, and 20 Republicans voted for it. So more Republicans in the Senate voted against this foreign aid to Ukraine. And this Senate bill included all of Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan together. As a matter of fact, Bernie Sanders, after this vote, he went on TV to explain why he voted against this bill. And I assume that it's the same reason that his colleague from Vermont, Peter Welch, voted against it. But Bernie Sanders said that he voted against it specifically because of the aid to Israel, because Bernie Sanders does not support the aid for Israel. The aid for Israel was included. So that's why he says that he voted against it. And I'm assuming that's the same reason Peter Welch voted against it. Not sure about Merkley in Oregon, but you had basically the entire Democrat caucus and then 20 Republicans passed this out of the Senate. The majority of Republicans voted against it in the Senate. And then when the House voted, this is the House vote from Saturday. And if you can see here, the House vote on Saturday, 101 Republicans voted for Ukraine aid, 112 Republicans voted against it. Not a single Democrat voted against the Ukraine. Not a single Democrat. Not a single Democrat voted against Ukraine aid. Every single member of the Democratic caucus, let me say it this way, every single member of the Democratic caucus voted for Ukraine aid, along with 101 Republicans, 112 Republicans voted against it. Now, just like in the Senate, you had three Democrats vote against it. But like I just told you, Bernie Sanders went on TV and said that the reason he voted against it was because of the Israel aid. So likewise, in the House of Representatives, you had 37 Democrats vote against the Israel aid, but they all voted for the Ukraine aid. Now, politically, these guys, these 37 Democrats that voted against Israel aid, they're not taking any political risks. No political risks at all, because a majority of their voters, the majority of the people that they represent in the Democratic Party are against aid to Israel. So these people aren't really taking any political risks, but they all voted for the Ukraine aid. Not a single Democrat voted against. So the Democrats are, as far as Ukraine goes, they are controlling the agenda in the House of Representatives, and they are controlling the agenda in the Senate with a minority of their caucus. Now, in the Senate, they don't have control of the Senate. But in the House of Representatives, they control the House of Representatives, and the Democrats are voting with a minority of the caucus to get Ukraine aid passed. So what's going on here? What is going on here? This Ukraine is what I'm trying to explain to you people is Ukraine is their agenda. How can it not be their agenda? Look at this. Their entire, not a single, when I was a Democrat, we used to be against wars. You're going to tell me there's not anyone? And that's the paradox here. I mean, if you talk to these 37 Democrats that voted against funding to Israel and ask them, and I've heard many of them talking about this over the weekend. Why did you vote against the aid to Israel? Because of humanitarian issues, because we're worried about what's going on in Gaza and the way the people in Gaza are being treated, and we're humanitarians. 37 people, Democrats, vote against the Israel funding based on humanitarian, because they think they're humanitarian. Can you imagine thinking that you're a humanitarian, but voting to throw more gas on the fire in Ukraine to get more people killed in Ukraine? So you care about the people in Gaza, but you don't care about the people in Ukraine that are going to die. More people are going to die. So you're telling me you're a humanitarian when it comes to Israel and Gaza, but screw the human costs that are going to be paid because you voted for more funding for Ukraine. Makes no sense at all. But Ukraine is their agenda. That is the point that I wanted to make. And if you need more evidence that Ukraine is their agenda, this is Democratic congresswoman from Denver. Her name is Diane DeGette. And when they vote to approve this funding for Ukraine, this woman starts passing out Ukrainian flags on the House floor. Take a listen, or take a look at this. Those are Ukraine flags. She's handing out the Ukraine flags. This is their agenda. Look at it. I'll take a Ukraine flag. Ukraine flag. And then here they are. This is her, Diane DeGette, passing out Ukraine flags on the House floor. This is her district, just in case any of you guys live there. If you live in Denver, southern Denver, not sure. Maybe this is up in Breck. I'm not sure. But if you live in this area, this is your congresswoman on the House floor passing out Ukrainian flags. This is their agenda. Ukraine is their agenda. Here they are waving the flags. Look at that. The House floor. So that's why that question is important. Will, when they ask this question before the vote, will more Republicans vote for Ukraine aid than Democrats? And he says, well, we don't know. We don't have the whip count. Yeah, you know. And you know for sure now because we got the whip count. And the whip count is more Republicans voted against it than voted for it. So why are you greenlighting their agenda, Speaker Johnson? Why are you greenlighting their agenda? This was when they invited Zelensky to come and speak, and they also pulled out the Ukrainian flag, and all the Democrats had signed it. There's Nancy Pelosi. That's when she was controlling the House, and that's the thing that stings the most, is because when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House, and they were just passing all of this Ukraine funding, billions of dollars, where we're suffering through high inflation and through Joe Biden's economic policy. You know, we were just itching to get rid of this woman. If we can just get rid of this woman, then we can block this stuff and stop sending our money to Europe. But Johnson comes in, McCarthy comes in first, and he approves it. And then Johnson comes in and then he approves it. Doesn't matter who's in this position. If they have an R by their name or a D by their name, this guy's going to get his money. This guy's going to get his money. It doesn't matter who's here. But yeah, so it wasn't the first time that they had Ukrainian flags on the House floor. And this is their agenda. Ukraine is their agenda. Why is Speaker Johnson green lighting their agenda? Now, our agenda is the border. That's our agenda, closing the border. And the Department of Homeland Security, is an agency that was founded after 9/11 because for some reason, even though the FBI had witnessed Muslims learning to fly in Phoenix, Arizona, it's called the Phoenix Memo. They had investigated this flight school in Arizona and saw that these Muslims were attempting to learn to fly, and they didn't care to learn to land. So they wrote this Phoenix Memo to the FBI headquarters, and FBI didn't do anything about it. Zacharias Massawi, who was part of the 20 hijackers, he ends up getting arrested just shortly before 9/11, had all the plans for the attack. The FBI in Minneapolis couldn't get a warrant, couldn't go through his things, and weren't able to stop the attack. And George Bush got a presidential daily briefing at his ranch in Crawford on August 6th, full month before 9/11, saying that terrorists were planning to hijack airplanes. He did nothing to stop them from hijacking airplanes. So all these balls are being dropped everywhere. So in comes the Department of Homeland Security. We need a new agency after 9/11 that's going to help us, you know, tie all these things together that we missed prior to 9/11. And we need a new agency. It says right here, beginning operations March 1st, 2003, after being formed as a result of the Homeland Security Act in 2002, enacted in response of the September 11 attacks. So the Department of Homeland Security was going to be responsible for the border. It was going to be responsible for veteran affairs here. And it's going to be responsible for, you know, what does it say here? DHS is the third largest cabinet department after the Department of Defense and Veteran Affairs. That's what it says. Homeland Security. So the third largest department. Homeland Security policy is to coordinate the White House with Homeland Security, other agencies, Homeland Security responsibility. So this is the agency responsible for the border after 9/11 and the creation of this agency. I remember when the first director of the Homeland Security was sworn in, Tom Ridge from Pennsylvania. So for 21 years, we've had this agency, and I think that it would be a understatement to say that our current Homeland Security director has dropped the ball, has failed his responsibility at keeping us safe because of the invasion and crisis at the border. Now, Alejandro Mayorkas, who is the director of Homeland Security, he's been telling us for years that the border's secure. There's no problem with the border. Take a listen to this. This is 3 years ago, just after Joe Biden was sworn in. And this is Alejandro Mayorkas giving us a rundown of the border.
Joining me now is the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas. Good morning, Mr. Secretary. I want to start right there. We heard the sheriff say it, the governor say it, and the migrants I spoke to say it. They are coming across because they believe they will be welcomed under the Biden administration. You said yourself 3 weeks ago, we're not saying don't come. We're saying don't come now. President Biden had a stronger message later. But the messages are mixed at best, Mr. Secretary.
Martha, good morning. The message is quite clear. Do not come. The border is closed. The border is secure. We are expelling families. We are expelling single adults under the CDC's authority, under Title 42 of the United States Code, because we are in the midst of a pandemic, and that is a public health imperative. We are encouraging children not to come. Now is not the time to come. Do not come. The journey is dangerous. We are building safe, orderly, and humane ways to address the needs of vulnerable children.
So the truth of the matter is that the border, when he was saying this, the border was not secure. This was 3 years ago. And since saying this, we have had record numbers of crossings over that secure border. Now they're admitting that the border is not secure and it's all Donald Trump's fault because he told the Senate not to pass a border security bill, if you believe that. But this guy was impeached 2 weeks ago. The House of Representatives finally impeached him. And this past week, they sent the articles of impeachment to the Senate. Now, everyone's criticizing the House of Representatives and saying that they're acting politically by impeaching this guy. But the idea to impeach this guy came from the United States Supreme Court. And what happened was, is that the Democrats were suing the Biden administration and they were trying to get the Supreme Court to issue some type of order or something to force this guy to do his job as Homeland Security director to secure the border. They wanted the courts to issue some order. The Supreme Court, they're the ones who gave Republicans in Congress the idea to impeach them and told the Republicans that, look, we're not going to issue an order. We're not going to step in and tell the executive branch what to do. The Constitution has a clear remedy for this for you. If you Republicans who control the House of Representatives, if this guy's not doing his job, you're not going to get an order from the courts to force him to do his job. What the Constitution, the constitutional remedy for you is to impeach him. So that's why they got the idea to impeach him. And then they finally impeached him last week or 2 weeks ago, and then send the art on party lines. All Republicans voted to impeach him. All the Democrats voted no. Oh, it's just weird how all the Democrats all stick together all the time. It doesn't matter if it's Ukraine. It doesn't matter. I mean, you have very little to no opposition in the Democratic Party. Very little. Now, you remember all of the progressives and Bernie Sanders' populist wing of the Democratic Party when Bernie Sanders were leading these sheep. Now there is no opposition in the Democratic Party. They march, pretty much lockstep. And if you have like the 30 or so who voted against the Israel aid, they're not taking any political risk voting against the Israel aid because that's what their voters want. They'll never go out on a limb. There's only opposition in the Republican Party. That's it. So I find that interesting. But the vote to impeach Mayorkas were on party lines, along party lines. All the Republicans voted to impeach him. All the Democrats voted not to impeach him. And then they finally send the articles of impeachment to the Senate this past week. Now, this was before Speaker Johnson gave them everything that they wanted, passed their agenda, because Ukraine is their agenda. Remember, it's their agenda. It's not our agenda. It's their agenda. They're the ones waving the flags, the Ukrainian flags on the floor. They're the ones gushing over Zelensky and voting unanimously within their caucus to support Ukraine. So it's their agenda. So before Speaker Johnson gave them everything that they wanted on Saturday, on Friday, the Senate voted along party lines. All of them voted together to kill the impeachment, and they won't even hear evidence and do a trial in the Senate on Mayorkas' impeachment. You understand what I'm telling you? That this guy, Speaker Johnson, gave them every single thing that they wanted, and they won't even have a trial for impeaching Mayorkas, and they vote along party lines. All the Democrats vote together. Not a single Democrat says, wait a minute, we should listen to this evidence. Wait a minute, we should at least have a trial. Wait a minute, this is what the Constitution calls for. They voted, they did this on Friday. This clown right here, you should have immediately ended that vote for Saturday and told them that we're not going to vote for your agenda. We're not going to vote for your agenda and Ukraine aid until you agree to at least have a trial, at least hear the evidence on Mayorkas and what Homeland Security is not doing and the failures they've made. I want you to listen to Ted Cruz here. This is after they voted to kill the impeachment and not hear a single piece of evidence. I mean, if this could be done, why didn't Mitch McConnell do this with Trump's impeachment and just vote to kill him? Because there's opposition, and there's opposition. There's two factions in the Republican Party. There's only one faction in the Democratic Party. They walk lockstep. I want you to listen to Ted Cruz here.
From Kansas is not wrong. In the 237 years of our nation's history, I don't know that there has been a more shameful day in the United States Senate than today. What we just witnessed was a travesty. It was a travesty to the United States Constitution, and it was a travesty to the American people. And it's important to understand why the Democrats did what they did. We're here on the Senate floor right now, but I want the record to reflect I'm going to do a very accurate count of the number of Democrats who are with us.
Not one.
That would be zero.
Zero.
Other than the presiding officer, and somebody has to preside. Not a single Democrat senator chose to come to this floor and listen to one word of evidence.
Not one. I love it. I love it because they always talk about party, putting the country over party and democracy and all this stuff. They killed the impeachment without hearing it. We're not going to even have a trial. Trump's on trial everywhere. Trump's on trial in New York. Yeah, they want the other trials to happen before election. They want to put everybody on trial. Trump had two impeachments. He had the trial in the Senate. He's on trial now in New York. Trials. They're happy to have trials. No one's above the law. But these guys, they refuse to even hear the evidence. They refuse to even have a trial. And then this guy, the next day, gives them everything they want, their whole agenda, their entire agenda. Let's listen to more Ted Cruz here.
I'm going to do a very accurate count of the number of Democrats who are with us. That would be zero, other than the presiding officer. And somebody has to preside. Not a single Democrat senator chose to come to this floor and listen to one word of evidence. When it comes to the Constitution, the Democrats concluded that Joe Biden and Alejandro Mayorkas, defying federal law, ignoring the text of the statute, deliberately releasing criminal illegal aliens over and over and over again, that's just hunky-dory. You can't impeach him for that. Every Democrat just voted. By the way, every cabinet member, guess what? You've just been given a blank slate. Ignore the law.
There's nothing you can do.
When Democrats are in charge of the Senate, the entire cabinet could ignore the law. It is no longer impeachable in Democrat wonderland. When a member of the executive branch openly defies the law. By the way, every Democrat just voted that way. They didn't hear one word of argument. The majority leader didn't stand up and say, here's the reason why it's okay. No, he didn't present that argument. They didn't read a brief. Nobody wrote a brief. They didn't care enough to know what Senator Lee just laid out, that the Biden Department of Justice went in front of the U.S. Supreme Court and said, if the executive defies the law, the answer is impeachment.
That's what the court told him.
Every Democrat to be blatantly hypocritical. Just last year, the Biden Justice Department said, no, you can't sue in court when we, the Biden administration, defy the law. The answer is impeachment. In like three-card Monte. Every Senate Democrat said, no, the answer is not impeachment. I don't know what it is. Actually, I do know what it is. There's only one answer left, which is everyone who is unhappy about the open border shows up in November, and to use the phrase, throw the bums out.
That's it. That's the answer. And in 2026, we got to throw the bums out of the Republican caucus, too. Why this guy would the next day continue that vote to give them everything they want. Nothing that passed on Saturday is anything that Democrats do not want. There is no hard pills for them to swallow. They got every single thing that they want and have gotten every single thing that they've wanted. Going back to McCarthy. Nothing. There's been no opposition to them. It's funny because Speaker Johnson tweeted, he's tweeting out puff pieces from CNN. And remember in the last podcast, I told you that I knew that Speaker Johnson was going to do this when I saw that Ukrainian delegation go to Shreveport in December. And the reason that Ukrainian delegation went to Shreveport and they started to organize with business leaders and in employers there in Shreveport is so you can get puff pieces like this. And Speaker Johnson is, you know, tweeting it out. Thankful for the support of the great people of Louisiana number four. And this is a puff piece of CNN going to his district, talking to people in his district that support what he did. Take a look.
In the small northwest Louisiana town of Benton, where Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and his family live,
I know he and his wife Kelly well.
Many people, not so surprisingly, offer glowing reviews about the speaker.
I think that he's very fair-minded and he's led by God and he really tries to make his decisions according to prayer and his heart.
And when you go elsewhere in Johnson's congressional district, like its biggest city, Shreveport, you will hear similar vibes.
He's a great guy. He's got great morals. And I think what he's doing is great.
I think he's a good Christian man. I think it's what our country needs. And I trust him.
And even from non-Republicans.
I'm a Democrat.
But you support?
I support Mike. I like Mike.
I'm a Democrat. Even from non-Republicans, I'm a Democrat. And you support the guy that's giving you your entire agenda. You're supporting the guy that's green-lighting everything that Joe Biden wants. Oh, well, that's surprising that Democrats love him.
From non-Republicans.
I'm a Democrat.
But you support?
I support Mike. I like Mike.
So yeah, he's giving you everything. He's giving you your whole Democrat agenda. Of course you're a Democrat and you love him. I don't want a speaker who the Democrats love. I'm sorry. I don't.
On Republicans.
I'm a Democrat.
But you support?
I support Mike. I like Mike.
So with that being said, what do the speaker's Louisiana constituents think of Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene trying to take him down?
I think that there's different factions within the Republican Party that all have, you know, all want to be heard. And you know, I think that Mike's doing a good job of managing all those different opinions. And I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is just causing trouble.
Does it anger you?
Yeah, it does. Because I think that, you know, the last thing we want to do is get back in a situation where the House is in turmoil and there's no leadership.
Yeah, there's no leadership right now, buddy. I'm sorry. The Democrats control the House of Representatives. So I found this speech of Ronald Reagan in 1986 talking about the war in Nicaragua, the Contras fight against the Sandinistas. And if you don't know the story, the Sandinistas were communists. Some of them are communists. Not all of them are communists. But and it wasn't a communist revolution when the Sandinistas took over, but Reagan and the Reagan administration, mostly his CIA, because this has been a, as you're going to see, a CIA thing going back to the 1940s. This, the Cold War, the fight against communism, the policy of containment, all that stuff was a focus of the CIA. And if you don't know, Ronald Reagan's CIA director, William Bill Casey, and was also his campaign manager when he ran in 1980. Nicaragua was a priority for Reagan, but it was definitely a priority for Casey's CIA. And the Congress introduced an amendment, the Bolden Amendment, which stopped the Reagan administration from supporting the Contras in Nicaragua. And the CIA, won't get into it in this podcast, but the CIA finds some crafty ways to fund the Contras anyway. But this is a speech, an Oval Office speech, that Ronald Reagan is giving in 1986 about it. And I just want you to listen to it. And when he's talking about Central America, replace Central America with Eastern Europe. When he's talking about Nicaragua, think about Ukraine, because the same things that he's saying in this, and the reason that It all sounds the same. The only thing that's different is different region, different country, but you're going to recognize many of the same things that he's saying about Nicaragua that they're saying about Ukraine now. I've found that this was very interesting. Take a listen.
My fellow Americans, I must speak to you tonight about a mounting danger in Central America that threatens the security of the United States. This danger will not go away. It will grow worse, much worse, if we fail to take action now. I'm speaking of Nicaragua, a Soviet ally on the American mainland, only 2 hours flying time from our own borders. With over $1 billion in Soviet blockade, the communist government of Nicaragua has launched a campaign to subvert and topple its democratic neighbors. Using Nicaragua as a base, the Soviets and Cubans can become the dominant power in the crucial corridor between North and South America. Established there, they will be in a position to threaten the Panama Canal, interdict our vital Caribbean sea lanes, and ultimately move against Mexico. Should that happen, desperate Latin peoples by the millions would begin fleeing north into the cities of the southern United States or to wherever some hope of freedom remains. The United States Congress has before it a proposal to help stop this threat. The legislation is an aid package of $100 million for the more than 20,000 freedom fighters struggling to bring democracy to their country and eliminate this communist menace at its source.
Freedom fighters trying to bring democracy.
Struggling to bring democracy to their country and eliminate this communist menace at its source. But this $100 million is not an additional $100 million. We're not asking for a single dime in new money. We're asking only to be permitted to switch a small part of our present defense budget to the defense of our own southern frontier. Gathered in Nicaragua already are thousands of Cuban military advisors, contingents of Soviets and East Germans, and all the elements of international terror from the PLO to Italy's Red Brigades. Why are they there? Because, as Colonel Gaddafi has publicly exulted, Nicaragua means a great thing. It means fighting America near its borders, fighting America at its doorstep. For our own security.
All right, so lots of very similar themes. And I was thinking about this going back to Mike Johnson saying, I'm a Ronald Reagan Republican. Peace through strength. You know, I'm a Ronald Reagan Republican. And you hear all these Democrats on MSNBC and CNN lamenting the Republican Party under Ronald Reagan. What happened to Reagan Republicans? What happened to the Republican Party under Reagan? But I want you to start saying to these people, if anyone says that to you, what happened to the Republican Party under Ronald Reagan and Reagan Republicans? You should ask Democrats, what happened to Barack Obama Democrats? That's the question I want to know. Not what happened to Ronald Reagan Republicans. What happened to Barack Obama Democrats? Why aren't you guys Barack Obama Democrats anymore? Because this is what Barack Obama said in 2012.
Governor Romney, I'm glad that you recognize that Al-Qaeda is a threat. Because a few months ago, when you were asked what's the biggest geopolitical threat facing America, you said Russia. Not Al-Qaeda. You said Russia. In the 1980s are now calling to ask for their foreign policy back because, you know, the Cold War has been over for 20 years. But, Governor, you know, when it comes to our foreign policy, you seem to want to import the foreign policies of the 1980s, just like the social policies of the 1950s and the economic policies of the 1920s.
So the foreign policy of the 1980s, why are you guys lamenting Ronald Reagan? I mean, why are you guys celebrating and calling this guy the new Reagan or even the new Churchill? They were calling him the new Churchill and all this stuff. And you're patting this guy on the back and saying, you know, this guy just said that he's a Reagan Republican, peace through strength. What's happened to the Democratic Party? Are there no anti-war Democrats anymore? No anti-war Democrats anymore. Because the 1980s called, is what Barack Obama says. 1980s called. This era called and they said they want their foreign policy back. So what happened to you, Barack Obama Democrats? Now, we have just a little bit more time here. I want to get into this book and who Smedley Butler is, and then we'll get out of here and then pick this up in the next podcast. But you'll often hear people talk about war is a racket, and as just a phrase. But war is a racket is actually a speech that General Smedley Butler gave in the 1930s, and then it became a little booklet, War is a Racket, General Smedley Butler. And it says here, War is a Racket is a speech at a 1935 short book by Smedley D. Butler, a retired United States Marine Corps Major General. The two-time Medal of Honor recipient, so he received the Medal of Honor twice based on his career, military experience, Butler discusses how business interests commercially benefit from warfare. So the speech in his booklet is about how his experience as a Marine Major General, and that his experience is that business interests commercially benefit from warfare. He had been appointed commanding officers during 1915-1934, U.S. occupation of Haiti. After Butler retired from the Marine Corps in 1931, he made nationwide tour in the early 1930s, giving his speech, War is a Racket. So he would tour around giving the speech, which was made into the booklet. The speech was also, the speech was so well received that he wrote a longer version as a short book. Where does it talk about the business plot? Well, let's go to Smedley Butler here. Smedley Butler, who is this general, Marine Corps general? Smedley Butler was a senior United States Marine Corps officer. During his 34-year career, he fought in the Philippine-American War, the Boxer Rebellion, the Mexican Revolution, World War I, the Banana Wars. At the time of his death, Butler was the most decorated Marine in U.S. history. Time of his death, he was the most decorated Marine in U.S. history. By the end of his career, Butler had received 16 medals, including 5 for heroism. That's how decorated this guy was. He is the only Marine to be rewarded the Brevet Medal, as well as 2 Medal of Honors, all for separate actions. So this guy was a hero, a war hero. And this is what he became known for and why he started giving the speech, War is a Racket, and wrote the book, War is a Racket, because in 1933, he became involved in a controversy known as the business plot. When he told a congressional committee that a group of wealthy industrialists, military industrial complex, that he told the congressional committee that a group of wealthy industrialists were planning a military coup to overthrow FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. With Butler selected to lead a march of veterans to become a dictator similar to fascist regimes at the time. The individuals involved all denied the existence of the plot. Which included father of George H.W. Bush, Prescott Bush, and the media ridiculed the allegations, but the final report by the Special House of Representatives committee confirmed some of Butler's testimony. So a fascist takeover, Prescott Bush. You remember me telling you about Prescott Bush's friend, Avril Harriman, a few weeks ago. Avril Harriman created the bank. Brown Brothers Harriman, where Prescott Bush worked. Prescott Bush was one of the chairmen of the bank, Brown Brothers Harriman. Their money was frozen because, you remember I shared this with you from The Guardian, how Bush's grandfather helped Hitler's rise. This article is not about how they support, how Brown Brothers Harriman supported Hitler's rise, how or how he helped Hitler's and the Nazis once they had already come to power. No, from the ground level, from the beginning, Brown Brothers Harriman was helping Hitler and the Nazis rise in Germany, and they have their funds seized for trading with the enemy. So Brown Brothers Harriman, Avril Harriman, like I was explaining to you guys in the podcast where we talked about Avril Harriman, his father was a railroad baron, represented the robber barons, the industrial elite from New York that Smedley Butler said that they were trying to get him. That's what the business plot is. Business people from New York that were trying to recruit Smedley Butler to stage a coup d'etat and to recruit veterans, to arm veterans to overthrow FDR. And Prescott Bush and Harriman and all of the northern elite from New York, the industrialists, the robber barons, they were involved in the business plot to recruit Smedley Butler. This is Smedley Butler in his own words. Take a listen.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. The plan as outlined to me was to form an organization of veterans, to use as a bluff or as a club at least, to intimidate the government and break down our democratic institutions. The upshot of the whole thing was that I was supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government. I talked with an investigator for this committee who came to me with a subpoena on Sunday, November 18th. He told me they had unearthed evidence linking my name with several such veteran organizations. As it then seemed to me to be getting serious, I felt it was my duty to tell all I knew of such activities to this committee. My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institutions. I want to retain the right to vote, the right to speak freely, and the right to write. If we maintain these basic principles, our democracy is safe. No dictatorship can exist with suffrage, freedom of speech, and press.
So he claimed that these business elites from New York, these businessmen, were trying to recruit him to stage a coup d'etat, and they absolutely were. It failed because they picked the wrong man, and instead of going through with their plan and working with them, he blew the whistle on them, and they changed their strategy. They did not say, "Oh well, that didn't work. I guess we're not going to do a coup d'état." No, they did a coup d'état. They waited 20 years later and did a coup d'état in Dallas at Daley Plaza. The same people, the exact same people, were involved in Daley Plaza, as I will show you, as were involved in the business plot. Take a listen to this clip about the business plot.
During the Great Depression, certain financiers and industrialists plot to overthrow Franklin D. Roosevelt and install a dictator in his place.
To conservatives in general, and certainly to business people in particular, Roosevelt appeared as a traitor to his class.
Could a plot to create a fascist state in the U.S. have succeeded?
Considering the times and the money behind it and the power of the men behind it, they would definitely have been successful.
Join us as we go in search of history to uncover the plot to overthrow FDR.
So that's called the business plot, and that's where the term war is a racket comes from. It comes from Smedley Butler, who claimed that the United States government sent him all out around the world to steal resources, to enforce the will of the United States government on the world, and to do it not for the interests of the American people, but for the interests of big business. And they tried to recruit this guy to stage a coup d'etat, and he blew the whistle on them. Again, they would go back to the drawing board, and they would eventually stage the coup d'etat in November of 1963 in Dallas. But this just sets the stage, and I'm just showing you who these people are, what they did, and it was the same people. Richard Nixon. We're going to pick up talking about Richard Nixon in the next podcast, but I was explaining to you how Richard Nixon was an ambitious man that was born the son of a poor Quaker family in small town Southern California, but he had big plans that he was going to make it, and that's the kind of people that these guys loved, because they can use someone like Richard Nixon and get Richard Nixon to do everything that they want to do, and they do it through with Richard Nixon from behind the scenes. Like, Richard Nixon is their puppet, and they're the puppet master. I have a clip of Barack Obama actually explaining how it works. Take a listen.
I've said this before. People would ask me, knowing what you know now, do you wish like you had a third term? And I used to say, you know what? If I could make an arrangement where I had a stand-in, a front man or front woman, and they had an earpiece in, and I was just in my basement in my sweats, looking through the stuff, and then I could sort of deliver the lines, but somebody else was
a puppet,
all the talking and ceremony. Wow. I'd be fine with that.
I'd be fine with having a puppet, a front man that would go out and do the talking, and I'm his earpiece, and he does what I say because I'm the money behind him. I make him, I'm daddy to him. And that's what Prescott Bush was to Richard Nixon. Let's listen to Russ Baker tell the story again, then I'll play us out, and then we'll pick this up in the next podcast.
What the father was also doing was he was moving up in politics, and he was moving up very rapidly in the Richard Nixon administration. This is one of the most astounding ascents ever seen. Several interesting things happened. Right after Richard Nixon took office, he arranged a date for his daughter Tricia with George W. Bush and sent a plane paid for by the taxpayers to pick W. up. This is a story that's not terribly well known. But all of these things happened. Poppy Bush, with almost no experience, first-term congressman, he gets on the short list of nominees to be the vice president of the United States with Nixon. Now, why would you put him on the ticket? He wasn't a particularly good speaker. He didn't have a really strong constituency anywhere. He was not well established or well known. And yet they put him on the ticket. Then after that, he runs for U.S. Senate. He loses. Nixon names him ambassador to the United Nations. And again, he knew nothing about this. One of his friends asked him, "What do you know about this?" And he smiled and said, "Ask me in 2 weeks." After that, 2 years later, at the height of Watergate, they made him the chairman of the Republican Party. Now, you think about this. This is an unusual ascent, to say the least. I wondered what that was about, and that, again, took me another, 6 months of research and down another rabbit's hole. And what I discovered was, just as I had not properly understood the Kennedy assassination, and I might mention, by the way, I had always assumed that Lee Harvey Oswald had been the lone gunman. I really didn't pay any attention to it. Frankly, most journalists know it's a quagmire, and it's just not something, if you want to keep your career on track, that you want to get into. That goes along with flying saucers. And so I never looked into that. But once I just started discovering the footprints of certain people associated with the intelligence community and associated with George H.W. Bush, I did have a reason, and that was the result was those four chapters. On the Nixon thing, it was the same thing. I had always assumed that Nixon was the bad guy in Watergate. It was just excesses, and that was it. What I discovered again was that we didn't understand our history. And the way I found out about this was I started seeing Poppy Bush's fingerprints on the Watergate story. What I discovered was that the Watergate burglary was not the signature event of this period. It was one of a series of covert operations that look, when you look at them carefully, to have been deliberately bungled. And they were all deliberately bungled in such a shocking way that really you would have to say that these were carefully thought out about how you could bungle this in such a way as to embarrass Richard M. Nixon. And so this forced me to completely see it in a different light. I've got several chapters on this in trying to understand why Richard Nixon would have even favored the Bushes in the first place. I went all the way back and I discovered, much to my astonishment, that the Bush family appears to have played a role in the creation of Richard Nixon. And again, this is not in any of the Richard Nixon biographies, that back in the 1940s, when Richard Nixon first ran for office, Prescott Bush, the grandfather, who was a senator and very, very close with Wall Street interests, was out in Whittier, and they were looking for a candidate to run against the Democrat there, Jerry Voorhees, but not because, as people said, because Jerry Voorhees was a liberal. The reason they apparently wanted somebody to run against him was because Jerry Voorhees was worried about Wall Street. Does it sound familiar? He was afraid, you know, after the Great Depression, that maybe we needed some more regulation. Maybe maybe Wall Street was out of control. Maybe it was lacked transparency, and it needed more regulation and more oversight. And so Jerry Voorhees was the leading person for oversight of Wall Street and banking, and they took him out with Richard M. Nixon. And so Richard M. Nixon, as best as I'm able to ascertain, was beholden to the Bush family, and this is why he gave them all of these appointments. But once he got in office, he seems to have decided, you know, I'm the president now. The president can do what he wants, and I'm not going to let these people tell me what to do anymore. And I describe in great detail here all of the things he did that angered the oil industry, things he did that angered the military-industrial complex, things he did that angered big companies of all different types, that angered the CIA. And when you start examining all these people, you start finding them all connected to Poppy Bush and all having their own intelligence connections, including the man who discovered and told the Senate committee about the taping system.
So they assassinate John Kennedy in Daley Plaza. This is young George Bush right here at Daley Plaza in front of the book depository. This is him. Look at that part in his hair. That's obviously young George Bush there in front. He's there at Daley Plaza. Now, he later says that he doesn't remember where he was during the Kennedy assassination, but we have a picture of him right there. That's him at Daley Plaza, with his hand in his pocket, that part in his hair. That's a young George Bush at Daley Plaza. So he may not remember where he is, but we have a picture of him right there at Daley Plaza, stage managing everything that was going on during the coup d'etat, the Clinton administration. But like Russ Baker says here, when Richard Nixon starts to assert himself and say, I'm president of the United States, I'm not going to let these people tell me what to do anymore, instead of assassinating Richard Nixon the way they did to Kennedy on the streets of Dallas, Texas, with the bullet to his face, they assassinated Richard Nixon politically. And the Watergate scandal was, as Russ Baker says here, was a carefully organized assassination of Richard Nixon. But he was their boy the entire time through the 1950s, through the 1960s. He was their boy being controlled by Prescott Bush, because Prescott Bush is the one who went out and found him. Prescott Bush put the money behind him, and he was Prescott Bush's puppet. Prescott Bush was the earpiece to Richard Nixon until Richard Nixon decided to assert himself. Again, we will pick this up in the next podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I hope you have a great Passover week. Thank you so much for watching, so much for listening. And I will see you guys on Friday.